the parasha this week, so we go into the new Sefer, the new book of the Chumash, Sefer Vayikra, and it's not always the case that Vayikra coincides with the approaching of Pesach. This week, this year does, and I'm going to connect it to Pesach as well. So what I want to do is discuss a little bit about, you know, the korbanos, the sacrifices in general. It's always a challenging topic, talking about sacrifices. But the Sefer HaChinuch talks about the meaning of the sacrifices. And I want to read to you what he says over here. The Sefer HaChinuch, in his commentary, the Sefer HaChinuch we know is the famous work on the mitzvahs. And he goes into all of the mitzvahs. He wrote, as I said many times before, he wrote this Sefer as a sefer for his son becoming bar mitzvah, to explain all the mitzvahs and going through all the mitzvahs to explain the meaning of them. And he writes as follows. He says the korban, the sacrifice, he says the concept of a sacrifice for the imagination is a very strong imagery for a person. It's a very strong impression for an individual, as a lesson to be machnia himself, to subdue himself and to lower himself, or specifically to lower the sinning spirit inside the person. That's the overarching idea of the sacrifice, to subdue and to humble the spirit who has gone off the path and has sinned in some way or other. As when he sees an animal, as he sees this animal on the Mizbeach being burnt, an animal which has no volition, no free will, no control over its actions, and it gets consumed on the Mizbeach, on the altar, gets burnt and is consumed. So also, it's a bit of a sobering message, so also a person, the spirit of a person, the person who has volition, who has free will, we can control ourselves, all the more so, we also, God forbid, will experience loss and destruction. That's what he says. So also, a person who sins, mitzad chulshas seichel, as a result of the weakness of his mind, of his seichel, of his intelligence, of his free will, tichle v'sovad, will also be consumed, will also disappear. Gamkein also, imtasmid b'pu'ulas b'hamiyos, if he continues persisting in animalistic behaviors, which are sins. Ke'achet lo yover rak m'shorosh b'hami, because sin and mistakes, sins, like deliberate sins, come from the animalistic spirit and part of ourselves. So by seeing the animal on the altar, it's a very humbling experience. You see the animal, you see this animal being consumed, and it's a reminder, it's a visual image and a reminder of ourselves. That really, this animal, this is only the flesh of the animal. It's flesh, and we are flesh too. And it's that flesh, it's that bodily spirit, the flesh inside of us, which gets us into all of the trouble which we get into. And we see that flesh burning on the altar. Like it's a reminder, a visual, very, very visceral experience. You know, we've got to be careful. We've got to be careful with our physical, materialistic, animalistic drives. We also don't want to experience that same fate. Now, he's not talking, not that the person's going to experience the fate of being, God forbid, burned, but it's more the allegorical message of the disappearance of the spirituality of us, of the disappearance of our eternity, which is really the ultimate tragedy, so to speak, of a person drifting away and not having any connection to God. Their eternity gets consumed and disappears. That's the animal sacrifice. And then he says the same thing also with the meal offering sacrifices as well. The mincha sacrifice, the mincha offering, which is also a subject of the parasha as well. Right, the mincha offering is not quite as powerful of imagery. A person is not necessarily going to get so kind of shaken up when he sees his flour and oil being burnt on the altar. But still he says, there's also a message in this as well. He says, even though it's not an animal, afal pisha hu ba gam kain, but it's also coming to subdue and to humble the Yetzirah. Sheyir ha'adam ki bishvil cheto, that because of his sin, nitzrach lisrof mamoni, now he has to burn his money. He has to burn his property. So the meal offering sacrifice is a consumption and a destruction of his own property, lekaloso. Even though it's not as powerful of an imagery as the animal being burnt on the sacrifice. But that's one of the ideas of the sacrifice. And the commentators talk about these ideas as well. That's the the idea of sacrifice. One of the messages we take from the sacrifice is, but obviously there's tremendous detail. I mean, there's so many details which the parashas go into regarding the sacrifices, and there's so many lessons and so many symbolisms behind it. But in the parasha also, you have mitzvah 116 and 117 in the Sefer Chinuch, which is the mitzvah of the obligation regarding the mincha offering itself. The mincha offering. So what is the mincha offering? The mincha offering is the meal offering. It's called the meal offering. That's one of the sacrifices I just mentioned. So it says, the pasuk says, when a person sins and he brings a mincha, he brings this mincha offering to Hashem, and it describes the details of how it's brought. So again, the mincha offering is made out of flour and oil. And there's all sorts of ways it's made. The parasha goes into all the different kind of pans, etc. But it's an offering of oil and oil and flour with frankincense as well, right? And there's different types of and there's also communal mincha offerings brought the meal offering, which was brought together with the morning sacrifice every morning, the Tamid Shel Shachar. And then the mincha offering brought with the afternoon sacrifice every day. That's a communal tzibor type of mincha offering. And then there's the individual mincha offerings as well. People bring individual mincha offerings for different things. What's the word mincha mean? Right? And don't tell me the afternoon service. Right? The word mincha, what does the word mincha mean? It's interesting, isn't it?
Flour.
No, not flour. That's solas. So mincha, right? So the Chinuch says the definition of the word mincha is, it's like he says the word mincha, it appears to me, he says, l'fiyah pshat, according to the simple understanding, ki al kein yikar mincha, it's called a mincha, aya tribute. It's called he quotes a pasuk, it's in Bereishis, it says that when Yaakov, he referred to the gift that he gave when Yaakov brought the gift to Yosef, the Egyptian ruler, it says, haridu li'ish mincha, bring this tribute, like a gift. It's like a tribute. So the word mincha could be perhaps translated as the word tribute. So the Chinuch writes over here, he says, because number one, a tribute is a small thing, is a small amount. In general, whenever you bring a tribute for something, or tribute, it's like a token gift, a token gift. So because it's a small gift, or it's a small sacrifice, in contrast to the large sacrifice of the animal, so it's just flour and water, flour and oil. So in that sense, it's called a mincha, it's a small tribute. Also, he says, because sometimes, many times, the mincha, the meal offering sacrifice, is brought as a nedava, as a voluntary gift as well. So that's also like a tribute. A tribute is like a free will gift. It's not an obligatory gift. So it's gift. So the word mincha captures either the voluntary nature of the offering, or the smallness of the offering, the size of the offering. It's a very small offering. That's the definite. That's the other two definitions. But obviously, because the afternoon service, we call the afternoon service mincha. So why is the afternoon service called mincha? Right, good question. Right, why do we call the afternoon? Now shacharis is called shacharis because it's shachar, the morning light, the rise of the morning stars. So that's appropriate. But the word mincha,
service.
So that's one. Some say because it's the shorter service of the day.
Sure.
It's reflective of the smallness, the small size of the mincha offering, because it's so small. So also the mincha service is the shortest, because the Shemoneh Esrei is the same Shemoneh Esrei as every Shacharis, Mincha, and Maariv, but you don't have the Shema with the brachas before the Ashrei and the Aleinu is germane to every service, right? So the Ashrei, the only additional part of Mincha is just the Ashrei beforehand, right? So in that sense, it's the smallest service, and therefore it's called Mincha after that. Another explanation is the word Mincha has nothing to do with the sacrifice whatsoever, but it has to do with the meaning of the word Mincha in a different context of coming to rest. Noch, like Noach, coming to rest, Noch, because the sun is coming to rest, because we have a mincha in the afternoon when the sun is setting, coming to rest, and therefore it's called mincha in that respect. Tosfos or others say that the meaning of the word mincha is the idea. It's very interesting that mincha, right? We say let's take a look at the Chumash in chapter 2. Rashi quotes there. Rashi says that when it begins the section about the mincha. So the pasuk says, "Nefesh ki sakriv karba mincha l'Hashem." When a person brings a mincha to Hashem, so it says, "Nefesh ki sakriv karban." when a soul brings this carbon mincha to Hashem, when a soul, what is the stress on the word soul? Rashi says, lo nema nefesh b'chol karbonus nadova ela b'mincha. The word nefesh, soul, is not stated in any of the other voluntary offerings with the exception of the mincha. Because it says, mi darka l'hisnadev mincha, who is the one who is accustomed to bring the mincha? It's the ane, it's the poor person. And that's typically what happened. Many of the individual minchas which people bring it because they can't afford to bring an animal as a sacrifice. So the poor man brings the mincha as a sacrifice, as an offering. So it's the way of the ani, the poor man, to bring the mincha. So Omer Kodesh Baruch Hu, so Hashem says, Mala ani olav ki'ilu hikriv nefesh. I look at that as though he's brought his very soul, the very essence of himself, because he had to go to more trouble because he can't afford to bring an animal. So he's struggling to scrape a few things together to bring a mincha offering. So it's reflective and expressive of mesiras nefesh, of self-sacrifice. So the mincha is reflective of the self-sacrifice. It's more apropos for the ani, for the poor man, to bring the mincha. And it reminds us of the self-sacrifice of bringing it. Self-sacrifice, self-sacrifice, self-sacrifice. When was mincha enacted? When was the afternoon service enacted?
With Isaac.
Isaac, Yitzchak enacted the mincha, the afternoon service. When did he do that? He did it in the afternoon. Well, he did it after Akedah's Yitz, after the Akedah, after the binding of Isaac, after he displayed this ultimate mesiras nefesh, self-sacrifice. And in the wake of that, he then enacted the afternoon service. Mm. So therefore, the afternoon service reminds us of mesiras nefesh. It goes back to the mesiras nefesh, the self-sacrifice of Yitzchak, and therefore it's reminiscent of the self-sacrifice of what? The mincha offering. Hence, the afternoon service is called mincha, reflecting the self-sacrifice. And the truth is that if you think about it, I mean, people who daven regularly, I think people will say that the hardest tefillah to daven during the day, I know maybe some people have a hard time getting up in the morning, but a few people, right? But a lot of people have a hard time with mincha, right? Because basically, you know, in a lot of shuls, they coincide mincha with Maariv at the end. The truth is, it's not ideal to daven mincha then. There's a time called mincha gedola, which is called the big mincha, where the earliest time for davening mincha in the afternoon. So many have the custom of davening mincha earlier in the afternoon, at the earliest time in the afternoon to start davening. So many say that's the better time to daven, smack in the middle of the day. And if a person's working and then to go to break out of the out of your work and then to go to mincha is very, very difficult, very challenging, but it really demonstrates mesiras nefesh. It really demonstrates what your whole day is about, that it's not just about making money and about running around and doing things for oneself. It's about ultimately serving Hashem, and therefore we put a marker in the middle of the day where we demonstrate our commitment to Hashem, our mesiras nefesh, and therefore it's called mincha. Mincha, a.k.a. mesiras nefesh. Mesiras nefesh, self-sacrifice after Yitzchak, who enacted mincha, after his self-sacrifice of the binding of Isaac. And that's the other reason for the mincha afternoon service. Anyway, that's the discussion about mincha. Another mitzvah, which is 117 in the parasha. And I say once, it's the list of mitzvahs according to the Sefer HaChinuch. Mm-hmm. So the Chinuch, this is in chapter 2, verse 11. So about the mincha, it says, Kol ha-mincha asher takrivu la-Hashem. Any meal offering, mincha offering, that you bring to Hashem, that you offer to Hashem, lo se'asa, this is our connection to Pesach, very convenient, lo se'asa chametz, it shouldn't be made out of chametz. Mm-hmm. Chametz, that's a familiar term these days.
Yeah.
He calls su'or because any su'or of a kol devash and any leaven and any honey, lo saktiru memenu yishal Hashem, should not be burned to Hashem. Mm-hmm. So three things are forbidden in the pasuk. And there's a mincha offering, it's a very, very strong warning. This mincha offering should not be made or should not have any mixture inside of it of either chametz, su'or, or devash, honey. Mm-hmm. So let's first define chametz and su'or. So chametz is the product, is the leavened product, is the risen product, bread, cakes, crackers. But we're not talking about putting bread and crackers. We're talking about putting flour into the mixture which is risen. So that flour, which the mincha offering is made up of, cannot be flour, which has to be within 18 minutes. So the in the base of Mikdash, they were concerned about making sure to have 18-minute flour, less than 18-minute flour all year round. 18-minute matzahs all year round. So the mincha, the mincha couldn't have any chametz in it. The word se'or is, they translate this as leaven, but it really refers to sourdough. So se'or, it's easy to remember because se'or, sour. Se'or, sour. So it's referring to the leavening agent. And this needs to be explained. Many people get confused. People think that yeast is chametz. It's not yeast is not chametz. Yeast is a chemical which stimulates the rising of the dough. The rising of that dough, once the dough is risen, that dough has now become chametz. But yeast, if yeast is made out of, we've got a problem over here. We have a chemistry.
Yeast is a microorganism.
Right.
It's not a chemical.
Right. But it's not flour. It's not made out of.
Right.
The point is, so what did I say?
You said it was a chemical.
Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. I'm just going to mark the time where that took place so I can take it out afterwards. Right, so the word, for all intents and purposes, to us, it's a chemical. Because a chemical should mean something which is very small.
Just don't say it to a chemical.
Anyway.
A yeast.
The point is that yeast is not chametz, right? Yeast creates chametz. Mm. But the ancient way of creating chametz was through using sourdough. And if you want to know what sourdough looks like, come to our house because my wife is constantly making sourdough. Well, actually, sourdough makes itself because my wife, the actual dough itself is the leavening agent, the ancient way. So it was just pure sourdough. So that's why she makes very good sourdough. Anyone who's tried it, she makes very good sourdough. Very good.
Oh yeah.
So, but that stuff is called se'or. Se'or. And again, easy way to remember that is by se'or sour, right? So the the Gemara says is the difference between su'or and chametz is chametz again is the product, and chametz the product is much more enjoyable to eat, right? Sourdough, even though there are techniques to how to make, I mean the actual dough itself, the sourdough itself, the starter they call it, that starter. You know, you can't really make that into a dough. I guess you could make it, but it would be very, very sour, very, very sour. So the product is the chametz, right? So the Gemara says the reason why chametz, and that this applies to Pesach also, the reason why chametz is forbidden unto itself because of it's not as powerful, it's not as a intensive rising agent unto itself. It's not going to cause other things to rise necessarily, but it has a very good taste. And therefore, that's why that's forbidden. On the other hand, se'or, which is the sourdough, it doesn't have such a good taste, but it's very potent, it's very intense, and it causes other things to rise. Hmm. So therefore, that's why both things are mentioned in the pasuk. Both are forbidden. Don't think because it doesn't taste so good, therefore it's okay. No, it has a very potent power to it to be able to make other things leaven. Don't think the chametz, because it doesn't have such power to be able to make other things chametz, it's okay. No, it's forbidden also because it tastes good. So they're the two things. They're the but the mincha offering can't have any chametz in it or se'or. We can't have any chametz and se'or next week either. And the other thing which you can't have in it is the vash, is the honey. And honey, the chinuch explains based upon the Gemara that the honey doesn't just mean bees honey. It means date honey, and for that matter also the chen moala yotzim in a peiros masukun, any type of juices which come out of sweet fruits, all of these things are forbidden to put inside of the meal offering, the mincha offering. So these are three ingredients which are forbidden. So he discusses over here, he talks about the meaning, the message behind these three things which are forbidden. And he says in general, whenever he talks about the shorish of a mitzvah, the underlying purpose of a mitzvah, he says this a few times throughout his work, he says that These are reasons to make the mitzvahs palatable. So these are concepts. All the mitzvahs ultimately come from Hashem. They're all ultimately gezeiros. They're all decrees from Hashem. But many of the mitzvahs have very obvious messages to them as well, which we're supposed to be able to draw out from them. And he says that, and he discusses what he thinks is the message of the honey being forbidden to be inside the flour offering, and the chametz and the sauce. So first, the honey. Like, what's bad about honey? So he says the idea of this is the honey, the concept, the prohibition of the honey is nomal yelodim rakin kedeliasram. We may tell our young children, our tender young children, in order to discipline them. Now he's writing that he wrote this initially to his own son who's becoming bar mitzvah. But I think the children for eternity, for the future, has been all the Jewish people, because we're all children ultimately. And it's a very, very important man, no matter how old you are, whether you're young or old, because the honey and the sweetness and the, all of this sweetened, all of the candy and all these things inside the meal offering is a siba ledimyon sheimayta adam. It's a way to stimulate the mind, to stimulate us that we should reduce the pursuit of maicholim mesukim, sweet fruit foods, delicious foods, and cakes and candies and all of the gluttonous the gluttonous delights which we enjoy to eat. Kaminaga hazolin, like the practice of gluttons and the inebriated, the mashchu lel macha kol masik, they just chase after sweet tasting foods. All they want is to fill their bellies. Lo yitein libo, ela maicholim moilim. They don't pay attention. This is the problem. They don't pay attention to the foods which really are beneficial for the body, except for uri. Utzrichel mechiyaso, and which are good for one's sustenance. Veshomrim brias ivarov, and to protect one's health. That's the proper way to consume. The proper way to eat is to eat only the foods which are good for the body. I'll say that this is it's very, very important. It's very important. Yeah, of course, it's like putting good gas into the gas tank. So you got to make sure. So if a person's going to be only eating just for their satisfaction, for their desires, it goes against. He says a bal seichel, an intelligent person, should focus, should intend when he's eating, when he's drinking, not for satisfaction and not for the gullet. If only people would understand this properly, if people would really understand, would appreciate this, that satisfaction, he says, is a disgrace to them. It's a disgrace. Indulging, physical overindulgence is a disgrace. Let alone to have pleasure and to gloat in it. But only that which is necessary, for one's health and well-being. That's how we have to relate to the food. He says, the men of wisdom have written, the chusha mishush, that the sense of taste, etc., ashuhu cherpulon, it was, they would say it's a disgrace to us, and we have to stay away from it. Now, I'll say that this is not applicable all the time. We said this before, that on Shabbos and Yom Tov, there is a mitzvah to have oneg Shabbos. It's a mitzvah to eat. It's a mitzvah to eat good foods and have enjoyment from the food. But it's all part and parcel of the mitzvah of Shabbos, of enjoying Shabbos and connecting to Hashem, even with the physical delights as well. So therefore, the rule of thumb, the general guidance is to strive for is that during the working days, to only eat that which is necessary for our well-being and our sustenance, only the healthy foods, and to steer away from all of the foods and all the sweets and all the candies and all the cookies and all the cakes, right, which are more an expression of self-gratification and desire. And he says, therefore, that's the message of not putting honey inside the offering. You know, the offering is the offering to Hashem, right? We are also offering ourselves to Hashem, so you could make that likeness, right? We're offering ourselves to Hashem every day. We are serving Hashem, and therefore we shouldn't intermingle inside of ourselves desire, extraneous desire for physical things for the sake of physical things. That's the honey. He also says another thing as well. Honey, when you boil it up, it bubbles very, very, like it has a tremendous amount of bubbling, like a lot of foam is created from it.
From honey?
From honey.
Well, I've never tried that.
Well, date honey, he says, devash mala risichosa harbe. So I looked it up and I saw there was this article that was all about how when you boil the honey up, like you get all this foam and a lot of foam on it. So he says it reminds us a little bit about the same message as we'll get to in a second about the ego of the chametz. So the honey, they're boiling up with the honey and foaming up. It also reminds us of ego and a lack of humility, which then segues back So what's the significance, what's the message of not having chametz inside your meal offering, right? Because the chametz, this is well-discussed topic about chametz on Pesach, because it's symbolic of the ego, symbolic of the lack of humility. The rising of the dough, the rising of the dough, the rising of the honey now over here as well. But the rising of the dough, so we have to subdue that, right? We have to subdue the ego and the arrogance, and that's one of the major messages of Pesach as well. Mm-hmm. We always say every year, right? The word chametz, if you spell the word chametz backwards, what do you get?
Tzemach.
So chametz and tzemach are in reverse, right? Chametz. So now what is a tzemach?
To blossom.
But a tzemach as a noun is what? Tzemachim. What is a tzemach? Tzemach is a plant. It's a plant. P-L-A-N-T. P-L-A-N-T. A plant. Tzemach. So is it? So you have plant. So tzemach. So chametz spelled backwards spells the word plant. Hmm. So how do those things work together? So if you think about it, it's very interesting. I heard this a long time ago from Rabbi Foyer in Muncie. He said that tzemach, right? A plant grows, chametz grows, right? Mm-hmm. And chametz, the growth of the chametz is the growth of the ego and the self. So, but both grow. The chametz grows, it goes, expands, and the tzemach grows as well. The big difference, there are three major differences between how chametz grows and how tzemach grows. Mm-hmm. A plant grows, so the way a plant grows is, number one, it can't grow unless it's connected to a source. It has to be stuck in the ground. It has to have roots inside the ground. That's the only way it can grow. That's number one. Right, the second thing is when it grows very, very slowly. It takes a long time before a plant grows to become large. And the third thing is that when it grows, there's more substantive mass in the plant as it grows.
Yep.
Right? That's the three characteristics of the growth of the plant. In total contrast is chametz. Because chametz does not need a source of growth. It doesn't have to be connected to the ground. So what does that symbolize? It symbolizes that the growth of the ego and the growth of the self is not really rooted in anything spiritually cogent. That's number one. In contrast to a plant, it's rooted in the ground. It's coming from real sources. The second characteristic is when it grows very fast. In contrast to a plant,
slow.
Right? Plant is slow. Chametz grows very fast. That's a telltale sign of a person's false identity. That you suddenly get tremendously successful in something. You win a lot. You get a lot of honor. All out of nowhere, you get this tremendous honor. Right? It's like easy come, easy go. Easy come, easy go. That's the nature of the growth of the ego. And the third characteristic is when the chametz grows, there's actually not an increase of substantive mass. Mm-hmm. It's just air, a lot of air in there, right? But the plant is growing. It's real growth. So that's what real growth. We have to reverse our process of growth to be more like a tzemach rather than like chametz. So tzemach is really representative of a true picture of growth. It takes time, slowly but surely, as you grow, you're connected to a real spiritual source, Torah, mitzvahs, and Hashem. And the end result is you have a substance to you, right? The pasuk says that the human being is compared to an etz hasada, a tree of the field. So the growth of a plant, a tiny plant, grows into a massive, beautiful tree. Massive, beautiful. And you think about a tree, it's so strong and so powerful, and the roots are spread out deeply inside the ground, connected to the Torah, connected to Hashem, and lasts a long, 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 long time, and has a beautiful foliage. That's the picture of proper growth. So that's the growth. So the chametz, we don't want chametz, right? Chametz, we don't want chametz in the flour offering. We don't want chametz on Pesach. So the other thing which he says about the chametz in the flour offering is the idea that he says, again, it's to awaken us, to internalize the proper perceptions inside of ourselves. He says, by distancing chametz from the flour offering, and then by extension, as we go to approach Pesach for ourselves as well, is because chametz is nasa b'shihah gedola. It's created, it's produced by a delay. The whole nature, it's produced by a delay, by a shihiyah gedola, like by a large waiting. By distancing chametz, which is made by a large process of time from the carbon, yikar dimyun liknos midas is rizas. Then a person internalizes this as a message for alacrity and nimbleness and speed, because chametz is the opposite of that. We can't have something which represents the opposite of alacrity, nimbleness, and speed. Right, so keeping chametz out of our lives is keeping laziness out of our lives. Keeping laziness out of our lives. K'moshe Amar Zichron Livracha, Kal Kanesha, be light like an eagle. Ratz Ketzvi, be nimble like a deer. V'gibo Kari, strong like a lion to do the Ratzon of Hashem. V'nischayav Inyan B'nischa Yichidim. And he says, before I read this, but the point is that the symbol of keeping chametz out of the meal offering and keeping chametz out of our lives, especially during Pesach, is it sends us the message of speed, alacrity, and enthusiasm. In fact, also it says by Pesach, it says the pasuk says ushamartem es hamatzos. The pasuk says about God the matzah, shamartem es hamatzos. Make sure the matzahs don't come into contact with any water to become chametz. But that's also in the processing as well. In the making of the matzahs, make sure that there's no water or moisture which comes into contact with the flour, which causes the dough to be, the flour to rise. So the verse is, Shemartim es hamatzos, guard the matzahs. So the Gemara makes the famous drasha, Ushemartim es hamatzos, Ushemartim es hamitzvos. Guard the matzahs, just pronounce the word matzah slightly different. Mitzvos, in other words, make sure to guard the mitzvahs. And then the Gemara says, mitzvah bo l'yodacha, if a mitzvah comes to your hand, altach metzana, don't let it become chametz, don't let it become slow and delayed without alacrity. Zrizim makdimim l'mitzvahs, people who have enthusiasm, they run to do mitzvahs. They run to do mitzvahs. That's symbolic of the opposite of chametz. Chametz is just dragging it out. I'll wait. You want to learn? I'll later in the day or tomorrow, next week, when I retire, that's when I'll start learning. All of these things. So the delay of doing a mitzvah is really a tremendous forfeit. It's forfeiting tremendous things. So getting rid of the chametz out of the meal offering is getting rid of the lack of alacrity, or getting rid of apathy. He says, getting rid of apathy and laziness out of our lives. That's another symbol of the chametz. It's the absence of apathy and laziness. So there's a book I have over here, a tremendous book. It's called A Student's Obligation. This is a translation from this famous work called the Chovas HaTalmida. It was written by Colonimus Kalman Shapira, who tragically was killed in the Holocaust, but his writings were lost for many, many years. And there was no, and there was, a, I forget the story exactly how they were, his writings were found, I think, by a German soldier after the war. It's a whole fascinating story about how they were preserved in some kind of container, in a hidden spot in the Warsaw ghetto. Mm-hmm. And they found it after years and years and years later. But there's an amazing story associated with it. Maybe Leib will tell me that story afterwards, right? He's always told, okay, he's not here. So this is a beautiful sefer. So I think I read this every year because it's so inspiring. So speaking about, chametz as being, and chametz, the forbidden nature of chametz inside the meal offering, that it's a reminiscent of laziness and sluggishness and like dragging around. And we want to eliminate this before in the meal offering. We have to also eliminate this the whole week now. We're in the thick of it this week. Getting rid of the chametz, running around, cleaning the house. Joe's cleaning the kitchen this afternoon, right? And everyone is busy getting rid of chametz from their house leading up to Thursday night. That's the climax. And how many people complain, right? How many people complain, it's so hard, it's difficult, it's very hard. So listen to this, listen to how he talks about preparing for Pesach with alacrity, with enthusiasm, with getting rid of the chametz. So he says, the days of the Pesach festival are not of this world. They are days of light and joy and the music of paradise. As Pesach approaches, a Jew who has prepared himself spiritually during the course of the year begins the physical preparations for the holiday. His soul begins to heat up from the light appearing in the distance. The ceremony of searching for leaven arrives, the first step on the threshold of the holiday. Our sages have said that Pesach expresses the quality of divine love. We discussed that on Wednesday night, Shir Hashirim, Song of Songs. It's all about love. A person whose heart is still closed will need to sit and think and reason to understand the connection between Pesach and love. I'll read that again. A person whose heart is still closed will need to sit and think and reason to figure out the connection between Pesach and love. But a person who's alive, but a Jew such as the one we have described, will not need to search for allusions or reasons. He'll feel all the commandments of Pesach, all their complicated details, and all of the special care necessary to ensure their proper fulfillment, as if he were a child hearing the loving words of his father who, from the midst of an embrace, coaxes him to do a task. The child runs with all of his strength, accomplishes what his father told him to do, and then turns to look at his father. He remains excited, full of love and respect for his father. He adds extra embellishments to the task that his father assigned to him out of love. He does everything joyfully, out of love for his father in heaven, and because he feels the compassionate eyes of God that watches all he does. Our Jew adds stringencies and anticipates all the possible implications of the laws of Passover. He searches for chametz everywhere, both in places where he might have brought chametz in and where he almost certainly did not. He wishes he could enter every little crack and hole to search. He leaps on top of the stove and pushes himself under the bed, for his heart is full of longing that he will not be calmed. It is difficult for him at this point to talk of anything but Pesach. All his thoughts and words concern the preparations necessary for the holiday, dishes that must be koshered, food and wine that needs to be purchased. He's completely immersed in Pesach. He continues to learn the laws of Pesach, studies their allegorical significance and what the Seder is hinting at, and so on. He's quick to lie down at night and then rise again in the morning in order to burn the chametz, and most of all to bake the matzahs that will be used to fulfill the mitzvah. He bakes his own, even if he already has matzah in the house. It is true that only a person whose soul is aroused, whose soul rises and ascends at least a little during the course of the year, will be able to feel what Pesach is. But during the year, there are times when a man's heart falls within him, and he says to himself, am I really a Jew? And even though I keep the Torah, who can assure me that what I do is accepted in heaven, or that I'm even counted among the least worthy, the smallest members of the people with whom God made his covenant, declaring you will be my special treasure, a kingdom of priests in the holy nation? This is the question he asks himself. Yes, at times I feel an awakening. I experience holy light, but what does this guarantee? These doubts occur during the rest of the year, but on Pesach, a person knows that he's a Jew. On Pesach, you know you're a Jew. One hallel is not enough. One song will not quiet the agitation of the soul. As if in the days of yore, the Garden of Eden has descended to this world, and he is in the midst of it. He has become another man completely. He has reached at least the lowest rung of what a true Jew should be. His heart and mind are different than they are the rest of the year. By the time the evening of Pesach has come around, he has become a smoldering mountain. The fire bursts forth. He cannot hold himself back until the Seder. Isn't that beautiful? Mm-hmm. That's the message over here. That's a beautiful message. So really ties into this mincha offering. So we're very fortunate to be able to learn this as we approach Pesach next week.